Okay, let's try that again. Good morning, everybody, or afternoon, rather. Today is April 15th. We're starting at 12:02-ish. And why don't we do introductions of board members? Let's go from my right, and we'll go down the line here.
Dale Romanini.
Why don't you give us a little bit
Dale Romanini.
Where you're from and kind of your background, and we'll do that, introductions.
Dale Romanini from McKinleyville, Humboldt County.
Hector Bedoya, the Healdsburg area.
Alex Hart, Siskiyou County.
Jake McKenzie from the city of Rohnert Park, the friendly city.
Greg Giusti, Mendocino County.
Molly Myers, Kadook Tribal member from the Klamath River.
Great. Okay, so just so everyone knows, this meeting, we're having it in person. Sorry. Everyone, this is my first time, so just give me a moment. I'll get the hang of it. Go ahead. Can we have staff introductions?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Valerie Quinto, Executive Officer. To my left are Nathan Jacobson and Bailey Toft-Dupuy, Counsel to the Board. To my right are Josh Curtis and Claudia Villacorta, Assistant Executive Officers. Across from me is Emma Cianfici, our Executive Assistant, and Deidre Wilkerson, our Administrative Officer. And other staff will introduce themselves as their items come up. Thank you.
Okay, so this meeting is being webcast and recorded, and we are in a hybrid session, so there will be persons available to public or to make comment in public or here in person and then virtually. Now we're going to move on to board member reports. Are there anything that the board members would like to discuss here, communications they need to disclose?
Well, Madam Chair, I would like to welcome our newest member to the board. She came many a long mile to be here, and she's introduced herself as a tribal member. I'd be interested in hearing which tribe, and just a wee bit about that part of our region from where you come.
Okay. I'm a Kadook tribal member from the Middle Klamath River. I was born and raised there. I've worked in water and on the Klamath all my life. I am a mom of five kids, and we are a ceremonial family. We're a traditional fishing family, and we love water, and that's what's brought me here. So I'm excited to join y'all and see what we can get figured out.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Mm-hmm. Any other board members have any comments they need to share? We good? Great. Okay, so just as a reminder for everybody online and here in the audience, anyone who is wishing to speak today to address the board, please complete a speaker card and give it to the clerk. If you're going to be commenting virtually, you should already be in the Zoom meeting room using the meeting ID and password you received from the clerk. If you haven't already received this meeting ID and password, you can go to our website at www.waterboards.ca.gov/northcoast. Click on the April 15th, 2026 button and follow the instructions to complete a virtual speaker card. You will then receive an email from the clerk with a Zoom login information. For those in the Zoom meeting, your camera will be turned off and you'll be on mute until it is your turn to speak on the items you have indicated. When it is your turn to speak, please state your name and affiliation if you're comfortable doing so. I am going to strictly adhere to a 5-minute limit, so please keep to that. During public comment, your timer will be on screen. For those calling by phone, we will run the timer and let you know when the time is up. As a reminder to everyone here, please silence your cell phones. And great. So follow me. Let's do the Pledge of Allegiance, please.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America.
State Board liaisons and executive officers reports.
Valerie? Do we have Dee Dee on Zoom to provide the State Board report?
Yes, Dee Dee is on Zoom.
Thank you.
I'm here. Good afternoon. Good to see you all, Chair Hart, members of the board, and welcome to the new members. It's really exciting to have a full board, and I look forward to meeting you personally. Hopefully, when we have our annual water quality control coordinating committee, which is a meeting that we host as a state water board, along with the 9 regional boards. That meeting's in Sacramento, and I don't have the dates before me, but we'll be sure to get the information out to everyone coming up here in May. So I have a lengthy report. I'll try and move as quickly as possible. We've been super busy, and so there's a lot going on over at the State Water Board. At our meeting on April 7th, we continued our discussion regarding our annual priorities and an update to our annual strategic work plan. And it's interesting because I think this is something that a challenge that we all face, and that is adding new priorities to the list, but really feeling uncomfortable about taking priorities off the list. And so what we've done in order to address sort of that challenge is, if we don't have an immediate action before our board for this year, but it's still a, you know, really important programmatic priority, we've created this new list of programmatic priorities list. A good example of that would be on some of these items I'll talk about today, and that is just ongoing work that we're doing, for example, in our safe drinking water program. An update on sustainable groundwater management. On April 7th, our board approved a resolution to refer the Delta Mendota groundwater subbasin, which is on the west side of the San Joaquin Valley. We referred that basin back to the Department of Water Resources. We did receive an updated groundwater sustainability plan from that subbasin, and staff reviewed that and evaluated it and determined that the basin had made significant progress towards sustainability. And so that basin goes back to the Department of Water Resources for ongoing review of implementation of that basin's plan. So at this point, we're really focused on the 2 remaining basins that we have placed on probation, the Tulare Lake and the Tule groundwater subbasins. And we have several activities going on with respect to those 2 basins. First, what we've determined was an appropriate action as we move toward implementation of requiring fees for groundwater extractions and also reports. We really felt that it was appropriate to provide for an exclusion. So these individuals will still be placed on probation, but an exclusion from reporting and fee requirements for those who extract no more than 20 acre feet per year and are not extracting from wells located within 2 miles of the Fryant-Kern Canal, where we've seen significant subsidence. These groundwater pumpers have a minimal impact on groundwater extractions, and this allows us to really focus on the more significant activities as we move forward in the development of an interim plan. In the meantime, we have received numerous requests from groundwater sustainability agencies within these sub-basins, in particular 8 requests from sustainability agencies in the Tule sub-basin. And these requests are that they also be excluded from submitting fees and also reporting their well extractions. These requests have been on the basis that these agencies believe that their updated plans or upcoming management actions will provide for adequate management under the requirements of SGMA. We are going to be considering those requests at our next meeting, at our board meeting next week. And I expect that we will soon be providing information about next steps as we develop interim plans for those two basins. All right. We've had some significant activity coming out of our Office of Administrative Hearings, where we have we're working with that office on two significant permits. One is on the site's reservoir project, and we have the hearings office on behalf of our board has released a draft order and a water right permit for that project. We have a comment period, and it's not just for those who have actually filed protests, but this is for the general public as well. That comment period closes on May 22nd. And then still moving forward on the Delta Conveyance Project, the protesters' rebuttal portion of the Delta Conveyance Project hearing will begin in June. On March 17th, our board held an interesting informational item regarding Mono Lake levels. So the board prior, long before my time in 1994, issued an order, a water rights decision on Mono Lake because of the declining levels and impact on air quality, public health, and the environment. And that decision was made in 1994, and there are target lake levels that haven't been met. And so we commissioned a modeling study through UCLA, and the contractor provided us with information regarding their modeling results. We had, it was a good discussion, but also lots of questions, and the water suppliers, it's the LA Department of Water, also had many questions. And so what we've decided to do is have staff hold technical workshops. I expect that the first one will be in May, and there likely would be two workshops, technical, focusing on the technical aspects of the modeling and potential management actions. On March 13th, our staff released a notice of opportunity for public comment for a proposed range of base flows for the Shasta River watershed. Our staff is identifying a range of flow options that can be analyzed as part of a scientific basis report and also economic analysis and future peer review by independent third parties. These documents are informational and do not in and of themselves establish flows, but they will provide really important technical information on a limited range of potential baseline minimums that could be used to help inform our board and potential regulatory actions, as well as to inform the public and interested parties on potential voluntary actions that could be taken. Comments are due with respect to this proposed range of baseline flows on April 20th. Okay, switching gears here to the McLeod Pitt Hydroelectric Project. In 2019, quite some time ago, the PG&E, the Winnemem Wintu Tribe, and the North Coast Rivers Alliance collectively filed petitions for reconsideration for our board's water quality certification for the McLeod Pitt Hydroelectric Project. In March, on March 13th, our staff issued a notice of opportunity to respond to these petitions of the project certification, and the notice solicits public comments on the pending petitions. Comments were due on April 3rd, so stay tuned for future updates on that. Proposition 4, focusing on U.S.-Mexico border funding for projects to address transboundary border issues and impacts on water quality as a result of discharges from the Mexican side of the border. Next week, our board will be considering adoption of draft guidelines and emergency regulations to administer funding that we received from Prop 4, $50 million for U.S.-Mexico border funding projects. I know there's been a lot of interest in the irrigated lands program, and your board recently took action on the vineyard order and ongoing interest as these irrigated lands regulatory programs evolve. Our board determined that it was important to have an updated expert panel report on irrigated lands as the regions have been, some more than others, in particular regions 3 and 5, that have been collecting information for quite some time. So we have a panel of experts that have been reviewing the programs and providing updated recommendations to our board, utilizing this vast amount of data that's been collected. On March 30th, our board released draft recommendations of the, this is called the second statewide agricultural expert panel. Comments are due on this draft on April 30th. There was a workshop on the draft held on April 10th, where we received comment. The expert panel, I expect, will then hold a public meeting, maybe two, to deliberate on the comments that they've received. And after deliberating, potentially make changes to the draft. After we receive a final report, I do expect that we will hold an information item to assess next steps, you know, really considering options that our board would have in reviewing, analyzing, and potentially implementing recommendations in the report, as well as working closely with the 9 regional boards. All right, turning to our integrated report. On March 3rd, our staff released the 2026 California Integrated Report final documents and summary of comments and responses were released. Our staff is now scheduled to distribute a notice announcing solicitation of surface water quality data and information to inform the compilation of the next report, which is the 2030 integrated report. The data solicitation notice will provide a data and information solicitation cutoff date expected to be in August of this year, focusing on surface water bodies in San Francisco, Los Angeles, Santa Ana, and the Sacramento subarea of the Central Valley region. Our board is accepting public comments on emergency regulations for electronic reporting of drinking water quality. Comments are due on April 30th, and our board will be considering adoption on at our June 2nd meeting. And then this is something that we do every year, and that is update our intended use plan for the Clean Water State Revolving Fund. Staff is preparing a draft intended use plan as to how to distribute funding for the fiscal year 2026-27 and plan to release a draft on April 27th. A board workshop will then be held to receive public comments, tentatively scheduled for May 19th. And the intended use plan outlines our plan for administering the Clean Water State Revolving Fund program and associated financing programs for this fiscal year. Our staff will be holding a updated fee stakeholder meeting in June of this year. But in the meantime, we'll be focusing on water quality certification fees. And staff has some initial thoughts on ways to provide for a more equitable distribution of those fees for water quality certification projects, and they'll be meeting with stakeholders on the 22nd of April. Wastewater needs assessment. We are undergoing the second phase of our wastewater needs assessment through our advisory group. The group began meeting in July of 2024 and has been meeting quarterly. The next quarterly meeting will be April 24th and focusing at this phase of the project on providing mapping tools and analysis and metrics to establish information as to needs, costs in order to meet those needs, and available funding and funding gaps. And then lastly, I would just want to take a moment to talk about the interesting and challenging year that we've seen hydrologically with, you know, initially some pretty significant storm events and precipitation and snowpack, and then those high temperatures that we saw in March, you know, really beyond record-breaking, really high temperatures that culminated in the sudden, the significant loss of our snowpack. A third of the water supply that we have in California is provided by the snowpack reservoirs and that provides for a third of our needs in the state. And the Department of Water Resources has been tracking these issues with higher temperatures and impacts on snowpack for quite some time, estimating that we're likely to see at least a 10 to 20% reduction of that important source of water in the state. And 2 years ago, the governor released a water supply strategy calling upon the state of California and local suppliers to really look for actions to conserve, be more efficient, but also expand the water portfolio in order to make up for this loss, suggesting that we hit a $4 million increase in water supply projects and through water conservation. Those figures have been updated with the release in March of the California Water Plan, the updated plan for 2026, revising those amounts to 9 million acre feet. So it's really significant that the water supply strategy that the governor laid out 2 years ago will really help us to, you know, start to move forward on these targets. And there's just collectively a lot that we can do through conservation, increased capture of stormwater, groundwater recharge projects, surface water storage, recycled water desalination. So I'm happy to provide you with more information on the status of that, maybe at a future update. And I know I've gone way over my time, so happy to answer any questions that you may have.
Madam Chair, just for the record, I believe our meeting with the other regions and you guys on the board is Thursday the 14th of May and Friday the 15th of May. Am I correct?
I'm not looking at my calendar, but that sounds right.
I did look at my calendar, so anyway.
I just opened mine. You're correct. Thank you. Thank you, board member.
Looking forward to being there.
Madam Chair.
Look forward to seeing you.
If I may. Mm-hmm. Hi, Dee Dee. Greg Giusti here. Thank you again for an incredibly comprehensive report. You mentioned the Shasta River and beginning of a process to provide a basis for future discussions of baseline flow. I think for the benefit of the new, and you're going to know a lot of this that I'm going to share here, but for the benefit of the new board members, this board has always had a very strong position that stream flow is directly related to water quality, to the point where we even directed a very competent staff member, Brian McFadden, to take the lead on developing a region-wide flow narrative for our streams. I mean, this board has in the past not been able to separate the two, stream flow and water quality. And I hope, and I'm sure they do, but I hope that the fact that you know this and you've heard about our work here, that you can convey that to your fellow board members so that we take the issue of flow, not more importantly than other parts of the region, but it is a top priority for us, because no water, no fish. No fish, no jobs, no cultural benefits. So I'm glad that your board is pursuing this on the Shasta with the challenges that it has. But just again, for these newer board members, this has been an important topic for this board for the years that I've been on it. So thank you for bringing that up.
Well, Board Member Giusti, if I may, thank you for your comments. And I'm just really excited about this next step of the process, because what we have been doing is implementing these minimum flows consistent with our emergency authorities. And those authorities, even though we no longer are in, you know, drought at this point, those authorities have been extended to us by statute for a 5-year period. And this gives us, you know, some really good breathing room to be able to develop the technical reports that I referenced, so that we can make better informed decisions and have all the information before us, rather than just focusing on those minimum belly scraping flows, you know, and not being able to look at the bigger picture. In the event that we move forward on regulatory action, our job is to protect the fishery, but also balance all beneficial uses. And I'm really hopeful that these reports will provide us with the important information that we need upon which to base those decisions.
Perfect. Thank you.
Madam Chair. Dee Dee, thank you for your report. Our region has a high percentage of federal land, forested land. My question is, regarding the reorganization of the U.S. Forest Service, what impacts do you foresee? Is this transition going smoothly? Any bumps that have occurred? How does this affect our ability to improve water quality with so many roads out there?
Yeah, that's a good question, and I'm really not prepared to answer it at this time. I know that if we look at climate change and the importance of being able to manage our forests in a more thoughtful way, so that we can both manage the fire risk, but also address water quality impacts and better manage forests so that they can, you know, absorb the important resource that we all rely on, and that's, you know, the water resources. And so I know that our board is really focused on general orders, in particular the utility general order that's coming up, and there can be challenges, jurisdictional challenges. So rather than shooting from the hip, I will just take some notes here and make some comments next time I appear before you.
Madam Chair.
Thank you.
May I comment briefly on that as well?
Yes, please.
I want to acknowledge Board Member Bedoya's point regarding changes at federal agencies, and certainly our partners at the federal land management agencies that are covered by our federal lands permit that this board adopted last year, I believe. 24. Oh my gosh, it doesn't feel like it's been that long. Those agencies, you know, have seen significant staff transitions and some, you know, challenges with resources. But I will just broadly say that our staff are still working closely and collaboratively with federal lands agency staff. We are just coming up on a deadline for the federal agencies to report to us under their permit. And so we do plan to provide a written update to the board about, you know, just kind of the overall implementation of that federal lands permit. So we'll plan to provide that in the next couple of board meetings. I think June or August is what we're shooting for that report to the board. And we can certainly take your question into consideration and see if there's anything that we can illuminate either in the written report or in, you know, verbal remarks to the board about how that situation is evolving.
Thank you very much.
Are there any other questions from the board for Dee Dee before we let her get on with her day? We good? Dee Dee, thank you so much as ever. We look forward to seeing you in May. I know several of us are going to be in attendance in Sacramento. So see you there. Thank you.
See you. Thank you.
Okay. Valerie, do you have anything on your docket?
I can hold my remarks till the end of the meeting. Thank
you. Okay, great. Okay. At this time, we're going to move to public forum. Emma, do we have any comments, speakers, requests?
Yes, we have one person who has signed up to speak in person and one person that has signed up to speak public forum on Zoom.
Great. I'm going to reiterate, we're going to keep our comments to 5 minutes. So why don't we proceed? Thank you.
AGP, can we get a 5-minute timer, please? Great. Our first public forum commenter will be Matt Green in person.
Right. Thank you for the time, Madam Chair, members of the board. My name is Matt Green, and I'm a registered professional forester. I have lived in the Wallala watershed for the last 28 years, and my comments today are going to be primarily about what was voted on last month. I was unable to travel 6 hours north and 6 hours back. I realize the resolution's already been adopted. I just would like to provide some comments for some future discussions that are sure to come up to this board. Member Bedoya, you started out the conversations when the resolution was adopted and rightfully addressed the topic that I had tried to bring up, that we've submitted 21 years of data to this board. That data has never been summarized. It's never been put in the public light what landowners have been cost or spending millions of dollars to fix. And it would be very nice before you ask for more data that hasn't been used to summarize that data to make it really obvious what has been done, what has been fixed, what landowners have been doing for the last 21 years, rather than relying on data from the 1980s and 1970s. I think that's really appropriate before you ask the cost of millions of more dollars for landowners to go out and collect more data that may or may not be used. I hope that really is something that we can hold this board accountable to and staff accountable to. It's a shame that we don't have that information to be used in these orders that are being adopted. We don't have a definition even at this point of time of what a road is from staff. We're almost a year into this process and nobody can tell us what the definition of a road is. Is a road a skid trail? Is it a road that was built 100 years ago that has probably been revegetated and healed over? What are we really talking about with these orders that we're currently already, you've already voted to approve one? We don't have a definition of that. That would seem critical to me that we don't have a definition of what you've already approved. And I'm sorry I'm not there last month to point these things out again. Going forward, I think that staff needs to do a better job of notification of landowners. There's a reason that I'm the only one here today to talk. It's because the vast majority of the owners in the Wallala watershed haven't even been notified that this process is actually going to include them. The initial notification was to 25 landowners. The current language that staff is working with is going to potentially include every single landowner in that watershed, and they don't even know that these discussions are going on. You have a technical advisory committee that has been developed that has one landowner, and that landowner owns or manages 30,000 acres. There is no small landowner component to that board or that technical advisory committee that is meeting in private It's not a public process. They're developing potentially things that are going to get implemented with this road order. So no public process. How does that pass Bagley Keene? How does that pass public disclosure processes? I hope you're starting to ask some of these questions to your staff as this goes forward. How is the RCD, who is in charge of this TAC, not a regulatory agency, if they are designing protocols that you are going to turn around and utilize to implement your road management plans? That really, really should be something that is addressed, because the RCD is not supposed to be a regulatory agency, but staff may be putting them in that position. Anyway, I know my time is coming up. I just wanted to provide some comments on some things that are going to be coming forward. I am always available to answer questions, and I really appreciate your time and consideration of this.
Yes.
Madam Chair, thank you, Matt. Thank you. Very, very thoughtful. Appreciate it. Appreciate you showing up. It's a good question. When does a driveway become a road if the driveway is 400 yards long? So I think you raised some good questions. I think there, you and I know that there are a lot of old roads out there that are not being used. They've been revegetated. They were never formally put to bed or abandoned, as the rules say. But at the same time, I think the fact that people like you are engaged in this, you need to read those, you need to raise those kinds of obvious questions so that we have clear understanding of what it is we're trying to achieve. So I applaud your involvement, and I ask you to stay involved and continue to ask questions, work with staff. I know they'll listen to you, but just give them a chance. They'll listen to you. I'll make sure of that.
Will do. Thank you.
Valerie, would you like to go ahead?
Yes. I'm not going to get into kind of the substance of answers of to the questions, because this isn't an agendized item, but I just wanted to clarify for board members and the public that the board action that Matt referred to from February was the Walla River TMDL sediment TMDL action plan, and that action plan very succinctly pointed to this North Coast Water Board developing a future order or orders to implement sediment reduction on roads that aren't covered by other orders currently, but it didn't define any of the details of that order. So Matt is right that, you know, the details are not yet set in stone, and there is still plenty of room for and plans for public process to define those details of the future orders. So just wanted to provide that clarification that even though the action plan was adopted, there's lots of public process ahead of us, and also a ton of appreciation for our staff, for folks like Matt who have already been, you know, engaging on this and providing important input, because this is a project that's very important for us to get right. So thank you.
Board members, any other comments?
Matt, thanks for voicing your opinions, and I'm sure there are other Gualala residents that feel the same way. And there are minimums, there are acreage minimums.
Thank you.
We have one more commenter on Zoom, Billy Ferguson. If you could unmute and make sure we could hear you. Billy, if you could unmute and make sure we can hear you. Billy, are you there? Madam Chair, he is online, but unable to unmute, it appears.
Um, we could move into the next couple brief items and then just check back one more time to give him one more chance if you'd like to.
Let's do that.
Okay.
Okay. So we are now going to be moving on to agenda item one, approval of meeting minutes from the February 18th and 19th, 2026 board meeting. Are there any change? Do I have a
second that motion?
I'm going to proceed right on to a roll call.
Board Member Bedoya?
Aye.
Board Member Giusti?
I'm still getting over the shock of the trigger happiness. Aye.
Board Member Romanini?
Aye.
Board Member Myers?
Aye.
Vice Chair McKenzie?
Aye.
Chair Hart?
Aye. All right. Now I'm going to hand this off to you, Valerie. We have presentation of our 2025 Water Quality Stewardship Awards.
Yes, thank you for that. This is a fun annual part of my job. Many of you know, the North Coast Water Board's vision is healthy watersheds, effective regulation, and strong partnerships. And, I think that may mean something a little bit different to each of us. We've had conversations as staff about how that shows up in our work. But to me, it means that working toward healthy watersheds, that's our North Star. That's what we're going for, is healthy watersheds. It points out that we, as a regulatory agency, we are responsible to administer effective regulation. And it also acknowledges that we're not going to get to healthy watersheds through regulation alone. And because of that, we need strong partnerships with folks in those watersheds to really, work on the whole big picture of watershed health. And so at the February meeting, our restoration specialist, Jake Shannon, provided the board an overview of our restoration program, including the long history of how things have evolved, consciously evolved with regard to permitting of restoration projects to make those projects more feasible in our watersheds. And so I'm really excited to present this award today to Sustainable Conservation. I'm excited because they're an organization that I have followed and admired throughout my career. Earlier in my career, I knew them as an organization that really helped local restoration practitioners to kind of cut through the what we would now call green tape of permitting for restoration projects. And what I have come to appreciate now as someone who works for a state regulatory agency is that they haven't just been helping local restoration practitioners. They've also been helping state and federal agencies to develop thoughtful permitting programs that will make it easier to get good restoration done on the ground. And so really just pleased to acknowledge that work, really pleased to have them as a valued partner in our support of restoration. And with that, I think I will invite folks forward to say a few words if you would like.
Can you hear me all? All right, orange light on. Wow, thank you so much, Valerie. Really appreciate it. And thanks much to the staff and all of the board members here. I'm Erica Lovejoy with Sustainable Conservation, and I'm here with my colleagues, Katie Haldeman and Stephanie Falzone. We all make up our Accelerating Restoration team. And wow, we're really honored to have this acknowledgement and be receiving this award. But I think our team can safely say that we think that a lot of your staff here should actually be receiving an award. We work with agencies across the state, as Valerie said, state and federal agencies, a lot of different folks. And some of the people here at this regional board are some of the most progressive and proactive innovators that we've worked with amongst the agencies. And it's not just because of advancing restoration tools like the statewide restoration general order, but really for how they show up. They are thoughtful. They're practical. They're genuinely committed to helping good projects move forward and protecting water quality and making the restoration happen. And it shows by the results. We do a lot of tracking. And by our tracking, we've seen that your team here has moved forward a tremendous number of projects under the statewide restoration general order, 47 projects at least. And that's about as much as the whole entire Central Valley. So that really shows tremendous leadership. And what's always struck me is how your staff, folks like Jonathan Warmerdam, Jake Shannon, Gil Falcone, they really treat people like partners, not just like the regulated community. And that's really how you get things done. They listen, they work to problem solve, they help make things happen. And that's not really easy with government, but it's exactly what's needed. And the leadership doesn't stop there. Your team has also helped to advance restoration across California, playing a major role in the state's Cutting Green Tape Initiative work, the Wood for Salmon work group, and countless other forums where we have finagled them and asked them to present and work with the other agencies and take on additional work in, above and beyond what they already do. And so we're really grateful for the trust, the partnership, and I think I can say on behalf of our team at Sustainable Conservation, we were really appreciative of this honor, and we thank you, and we're looking forward to continuing our collaboration and getting more done together with your team. So thank you so much. Thank you, Valerie.
Thank you so much. Well deserved. Thank you.
Well, unless there are other remarks, I'll come get the certificate to present, and then we can kind of clump together for a photo, maybe.
Would you be willing to take a photo?
Sure.
You can use
Let's clump up here, and I'm going to ask board members to clump together standing behind us, and maybe we'll be able to all of us make sure to watch out for the cords and cameras and such here.
Well, that's that.
Is there a second? Do we have a second?
No, we do not have a second award.
Okay.
This time around.
Oh, yes.
Second public speaker. Yes, that's what you were talking about. Can we check and see if our public forum commenter on Zoom is able to unmute now?
Yes. Billy, can you unmute and see if we can hear you, please? Billy, are you there? Madam Chair, Billy is still in the room, but is not unmuting.
Okay, so let's proceed through our next, we're going to proceed through item three, and at the end, once we reach the conclusion of item three, we can offer it again, just if he's still there. So, okay, moving on. We are now on to item three, administrative civil liability complaint hearing for R12026-0011, issued to Mr. Jorge Sanchez Herrera. And I'll let the team kind of get settled in here before I read our statement. Is everybody good on bathroom breaks? Are we, any requests there? We good? Okay, great. Perfect. Okay. This is the time and place for a public hearing to consider issuance of an order for administrative civil liability to Jorge Sanchez Herrera for the violation alleged in administrative civil liability complaint R12060011. The complaint alleges violation of a cleanup and abatement order related to a site in Mendocino County. The complaint seeks penalties of $50,000 for violation of Water Code Section 13304. This hearing will be conducted in accordance with the hearing procedure that was issued with the complaint and instructions provided here today. In this matter, we have separated the functions of staff between those who are acting in a prosecutorial role, and will be presenting the proposed order, complaint, and evidence for this board's consideration, and those who will advise the board in its consideration of this matter. All parties are subject to the same applicable rules and regulations, including the prohibition on ex parte communications with board members and the advisory team. The advisory team for this matter includes the board's executive officer, Valle Quinto, and counsel to the board, Bailey Toff. How do you pronounce your last name, Bailey?
Toft Dupuy.
Dupuy, okay. Bailey Toft Dupuy and Nate Jacobson. The prosecution team and other parties will introduce themselves as the hearing proceeds. This hearing is being conducted both in person and via video conference. During this hearing, the board will consider relevant evidence and testimony to decide whether to issue an order assessing the proposed liability, issue a modified order assessing a higher or lower amount, or to reject the proposed liability. Prosecution team has submitted a proposed order for the board's consideration. Generally, we're going to go over hearing proceedings, which will be 1, parties opening statements, 2, prosecution team's case presentation and direct testimony from witnesses, 3, cross-examination of prosecution witnesses, 4, respondent Sanchez Herrera case presentation and direct testimony from witnesses, 5, cross-examination of Mr. Sanchez Herrera's witnesses, 6, prosecution's rebuttal and Mr. Sanchez Herrera's rebuttal as necessary, 7, closing arguments, 8, public comments, if any, following the conclusion of the party's cases. Any members of the public wishing to give non-evidentiary policy statements will have 5 minutes to do so. 9, the board may meet in closed session to deliberate on this matter. Is Mr. Sanchez in the audience here today? No? Okay. Well, we're going to go ahead with the proceeding order I just described.
Can we also just confirm that there's no one in the Zoom room for Mr. Sanchez Herrera?
Madam Chair?
Yes, Vice Chair McKenzie.
Is Mr. Herrera present?
That's what we're checking on right now. We've confirmed that he's not in the room, and Emma just confirmed that he's not in the Zoom room either.
Okay.
Thank you.
No, we're confirming. Emma, are we? No one's in the Zoom.
That is correct. No one is in the Zoom.
Okay. Are there any questions before we proceed on the general order? We all clear? Great. Okay. Each of these elements is at your discretion and subject to your timeline. Each witness that the parties intends to call will be required to take an oath. For those planning to give testimony, please stand and take the following oath. Do you swear the testimony you are about to give is the truth? Prior to testifying, please state your name, affiliation, and whether you have taken the oath. Do I need to read? Do I need to read this part? So he stayed in there. Do you read that part?
Yeah, might as well.
Okay. Okay. One last part. As was stated in the hearing procedure, each party will be allowed a total of 30 minutes. Neither party requested additional time, and the parties may use their time as they choose. May be modified. These procedures and time allocations may be modified as needed upon the request and for good cause. Board members and members of the advisory team may ask questions at any time. The timer will stop for procedural discussions, questions from the board members or the advisory team, or other causes such as technical issues. The timer will show time left to each party. Are there any other matters from the parties? Any questions before we begin?
No.
Great. Prosecution, opening statements.
Good afternoon, Chair Hart and members of the board, and welcome Board Member Myers. My name is Kason Grady of your staff, and I have taken the oath. I supervise the Agriculture and Enforcement Division and am the Regional Cannabis Program Manager. I am joined by other members of our prosecution team, including our Assistant Executive Officer and Lead Prosecutor, Claudia Villacorta, and to my left, Engineering Geologist and Lead Technical Staff for this case, Ermias Berge, and Staff Counsel to my left, Patrick Lewis, as well as Staff Counsel Dominic Moscatello and other members of the prosecution team in the audience. We are here today to present our case for you to adopt an administrative civil liability to Jorge Sanchez Herrera, who we will also refer to as the respondent, for alleged violations of a cleanup and abatement order issued by this board. During today's presentation, I will provide an overview of the cannabis regulatory program and associated enforcement strategy, a little background for new board members, with an overview of this enforcement case, followed by other members of the prosecution team reviewing condition of the property with a chronology of the various enforcement actions and compliance assistance communications that we've attempted with the respondent. We will then discuss in more detail the violations the prosecution team is alleging, and we'll provide a brief overview of the liability adjustments and calculations that justify the proposed penalty. I would first like to highlight our cannabis regulatory program. Commercial cannabis cultivators in California are required to enroll for coverage from the State Water Board under the Cannabis Cultivation General Waste Discharge Requirements, in addition to local permits from the county, agreements with the Department of Fish and Wildlife, and licenses from the State Department of Cannabis Control. Those enrollees, and really all cannabis cultivators, are required to conduct cultivation activities in accordance with the statewide cannabis cultivation policy. Enrollees are required to pay annual fees, and within 90 days of enrolling, submit a site management plan, which describes how their operations comply with the water quality protective standards in the cannabis cultivation policy. This is the core of how the regulatory program works. The cultivators work with their own qualified professionals to determine how to comply with the requirements to protect water quality. As I presented to you back in December of 2024, you have relatively few staff to regulate almost 2,000 enrollees, in addition to thousands of unlicensed cultivators in the North Coast region. So we rely on cultivators working with qualified professionals that they hire with input from your staff when needed. The respondent was never enrolled in the regulatory program, and as we will show today, he did not conduct his cultivation operation, commercial operation, in a manner that was protective of water quality. The thousands of illegal cultivators, such as the respondent, represent a significant threat to water quality through the conditions on their properties, by undermining the Water Board's regulatory program, and their attempts to subvert your enforcement authority. These cultivators are able to gain an economic advantage by avoiding to pay for permitting fees, hiring professionals, implementing site improvements. this also detracts from your staff's ability to support enrollees in our program. In December 2024, I presented to the board a cannabis program-specific enforcement strategy aimed at improving staff efficiency and effectiveness in addressing the thousands of illegal cultivation sites in the North Coast. The strategy responds to the resource-intensive nature of compliance assistance and enforcement, which has slowed the progress towards achieving water quality protection in this industry. Our strategy includes improving efficiencies and enforcement actions by providing quick, clear direction to cultivators and creating predictable enforcement pathways. One pathway is the use of streamlined cleanup and abatement orders and a format that we use to address violations that are straightforward and where required remedial actions are limited in scope. For example, removing waste piles, stabilizing a small disturbed area, abating discrete discharges. In essence, sediment, trash, and debris cleanup where professionals, plans, and permits are not required. Our strategy includes expediting enforcement on unpermitted cultivation sites by taking these three actions in addition to others. Issuing streamlined, also known as compressed cleanup and abatement orders, and issuing them quickly for simple remedial actions. Assessing penalties for discharge violations and assessing penalties for violations of cleanup and abatement orders. I have bolded two of these, I guess even three, because the ones in bold apply to this case today. We issued a streamlined cleanup and abatement order quickly, and the respondent failed to perform those simple cleanup actions or even respond to your staff. So we are now here to propose a penalty for violations of that order. Having reviewed the program context, we are presenting this case against Jorge Sanchez Herrera for the board's consideration. Staff recommends the imposition of $50,000 in liability for failure to comply with a cleanup and abatement order issued to address the observed and threatened impacts to water quality resulting from unlicensed cannabis cultivation. As the property owner, the respondent is responsible for the conditions on his property, and as the named discharger in the cleanup and abatement order, he is liable for noncompliance with that order. He has not only failed to comply with order requirements, but he has also failed to engage with your staff through all of our efforts to provide compliance assistance and throughout the lead up in this hearing process. He has failed to make an argument that he cannot afford the proposed penalty. We will demonstrate that the prosecutorial staff have fulfilled our burden of proof to demonstrate that he does indeed have the ability to pay the penalty with available property assets. The respondent's violation of the cleanup order includes failure to implement corrective actions and to submit required confirmation, including photographic documentation of implementation and waste disposal receipts. I want to emphasize that since the penalty is based on the violation of the order requirements, it is not based on the egregiousness of the site conditions themselves, but rather on the respondent's failure to clean up the site by the required deadlines in the order. 10 days of violation is appropriate for this case based on the specifics of this case, including the simplicity of the violation, and exercise of prosecutorial discretion in line with the cannabis enforcement strategy to issue and proceed through the enforcement process quickly. Allowing responsible parties to ignore board orders without consequences would only send the message that noncompliance carries little risk. I encourage you to hold the respondent accountable by issuing this penalty today and reinforcing that compliance is not optional. With that introduction, Mr. Berhe, our lead technical staff geologist, will now present the evidence and rationale to support our recommendation to adopt the liability amount proposed in the complaint. Thank you.
Test. Dear Chair Hart, members of the board, I am Hermias Berhe, engineering geologist in the Southern Agriculture Unit. primarily working in the cannabis program. I've sworn in today, and I prepared my declaration submitted as Exhibit PT37, and I affirm all the statements in that document are true and correct. Now I proceed to my presentation by showing location maps of the property. The property is in Spy Rock area, north of Dos Rios in Mendocino County. The map on the left shows property location at the red star, and the map on the right shows property boundary with red hashed polygon.
Excuse me, Mr. Berhe. Can you move the microphone a little bit closer to your mouth, please? Thank you.
Okay. This is a closer view of the property showing its proximity to a river which runs along the southwestern portion of the property. And this map also shows tributaries to a river directly draining from the property. I inspected the property on October 30, 2024, during a criminal search warrant obtained by California Department of Fish and Wildlife. During my inspection, I observed unpermitted cannabis cultivation and related activities with discharges and threatened discharge of waste to waters of the state. On July 30, 2025, I transmitted an inspection report, a notice of violation, and a draft cleanup and abatement order documenting the conditions I observed on the property and requesting comments on the draft cleanup and abatement order. After this package got returned, I retransmitted it to an alternative mailing address on September 3, 2025. I received no response for these communications. On September 23, 2025, I transmitted the final cleanup and abatement order. To show the property conditions and the impacts of cannabis cultivation and related activities, here is a slide contrasting historical imagery from pre- and post-property development for cannabis cultivation. The pre-development image on the right, on the left, is from July of 2004, and the post-development image on the left, on the right, is from September of 2023. The red polygons on the right image are included to show graded cultivation flats for cannabis cultivation. The northern and the southern graded flats are within riparian and setbacks of the water courses. The blue broken lines on these images are included to show the original configuration of the water courses around these graded flats.
Question, if I may?
Yes.
So in the 2023 image, almost in the middle of the image, it looks to be a gray structure. Is that a building? Is that some kind of structure to hold chemicals? What am I looking at that's not in the 2004 image? Looks like a truck or a...
Are you referring to the one which is on the left of the property?
It's...
Major pointer doesn't work well. I mean, it works, but it doesn't reflect off the screen.
Oh.
I'm just trying to understand what I'm seeing. It looks like a structure of some kind.
Yeah, it's not reflecting on the screen.
That's
use it for storage of chemicals and plus a house structure.
Was that there when you did your inspection on 10/30/24?
Yes, it was there.
Okay, thank you. On 10/30/24, was there any representative of the property on site when you made the inspection with Fish and Wildlife personnel?
No, there was not anyone from
Thank you.
Property owners. Starting from this slide, I will show some photos of conditions to be addressed under the cleanup and abatement order. Photos on the first four slides are from my October 30, 2024 inspection of the property. The last photo is from September 3rd, 2025, a second inspection of the property conducted by your staff, Adonna White. This slide shows photos of cultivation area on slopes very close to a watercourse, depicted here as blue broken lines. These conditions create a direct pathway to runoff to carry sediment, nutrient, and waste into the channel, degrading water quality and impacting aquatic life. Here is a photo showing cannabis plant waste disposed up gradient of a watercourse. This waste includes leaves, stems, and plastic blue twines disposed up gradient of a watercourse without containment. This waste is placed where it is susceptible to runoff. If mobilized, this material could degrade water quality by increasing sediment and nutrient loading and reducing dissolved oxygen and posing risk to aquatic life. This slide shows photos of a ditch around a cultivation area depicted here as red broken lines and is hydrologically connected to watercourses downgradient of the watercourse indicated on the right photo by a yellow arrow. This ditch creates a pathway for stormwater loaded with sediments and pollutants from the cultivation area to the watercourse downgradient. This slide shows a photo of a small bottle of an illegal pesticide metamidophos identified in the red rectangle within the storage area. The presence of a banned pesticide poses a significant threat to water quality if applied to plants. This slide shows a photo which your staff, Adonna White, took during a second inspection of the property. Rather than clean up the property, the respondent replanted cannabis, which resulted in another criminal search warrant inspection of the property on September 3rd, 2025. Staff observed that no cleanup work had been completed since my first inspection, and this photo shows a pile of trash without containment and cover, threatening waste discharge to nearby waterways. The cleanup order requires implementation and submittal of photographic confirmation of implementation of corrective actions and disposal receipts from a disposal facility that accepts such wastes by November 15, 2025. The required corrective actions include the following: application of erosion control-based management practices to disturbed area, proper disposal of refuse and solid waste, proper disposal of hazardous waste, and disconnecting and restoring hydrologically connected ditches. Now that we have briefly introduced the required actions that are the subject of our complaint, let's review a timeline of the respondent's performance after issuance of the final order. November 15, 2025 was the deadline for submittal of confirmation of implementation of corrective actions required under the cleanup order. On November 18, 2025, I transmitted a notice of violation for failure to comply with required actions of the order. On December 2, 2025, Ms. Erica Vargas contacted us confirming receipt of the letters from mutual contacts, and she provided an alternative mailing address. She also requested an extension on the deadline. On December 4, 2025, I contacted Ms. Vargas by phone and sent a follow-up email about the status of the case and encouraged them to implement corrective actions as soon as possible to avoid liability. On the same day, on December 4th, 2025, next case, Ms. Vargas responded to my email stating that they will start work immediately. On December 12th, 2025, I emailed Ms. Vargas requesting the status of implementation of corrective actions and clarification on her role on this case. In this case, I received no response for all these communications. On December 31st, 2025, I transmitted Spanish translations of the NOVs report of the October 30th, 2024 inspection of the property and the cleanup order to the respondent's address and emailed a copy to Ms. Vargas. On January 1st, 2026, I received an email response from Ms. Vargas thanking me for sending these translated documents. On January 15, 2026, Adonna White, your staff, transmitted a notice of violation and report of her second inspection of September 3rd, 2025, inspection of the property, and their Spanish translations by emailing to Ms. Vargas and mailing to the respondent. We received no response of these communications. Then on January 16, 2026, I transmitted the complaint to both PO Box and the respondent's addresses on file. On January 26, 2026, the complaint was delivered and the North Coast Water Board received confirmation of delivery of the complaint. On February 3rd, 2026, our division chief, Kaysen Grady, and myself attempted to contact Ms. Vargas and the respondent via phone to check on the status of cleanup of the property and to confirm if Spanish is still the respondent's preferred language. We received no response again. On the same day, on February 3rd, 2026, I contacted Ms. Vargas via email to check on the status of cleanup of the property and whether the translated documents were provided to the respondent and to confirm our assumption that Spanish is respondent's preferred language. On February 5th, 2026, Ms. Vargas responded to my email stating that she is translating translating for the respondent and requested if they could get 1 month of additional time to complete all the work required under the order, and thanking me for sending the Spanish translated documents. On February 6, 2026, on behalf of the prosecution team, I responded to Ms. Vargas' email stating that the North Coast Water Board already issued an administrative civil liability complaint and completing the required actions under the order are not sufficient to resolve the complaint. However, the prosecution team is willing to meet with her and the respondent to settle the case and avoid a hearing. I received no response after this. We are alleging the respondent violated Water Code Section 13.304 by failing to implement corrective actions required under the cleanup and abatement order. Days of violation are alleged from November 16, 2025 through November 25, 2025 for a total of 10 days. Pursuant to the North Coast Water Board's enforcement strategy, cannabis-specific enforcement strategy to expedite formal enforcement and assess penalties when deadline is missed in a cleanup and abatement order, staff prioritized this case when an administrative civil when the required actions were violated on November 15, 2025. Although this violation is ongoing, the complaint seeks liability for days of violation beginning on November 16, 2025 through November 25, 2025. I will now give you a brief overview of our application of the penalty methodology, but we are happy to answer any questions the board may have about the details. In determining the total base liability, staff applied enforcement policies penalty calculation methodology. Steps 1 and 2 of the enforcement policy methodology are not applicable to this case since we are alleging non-discharge violations for violations of required actions of an order. In step 3, staff considered the potential for harm score of measure and deviation from requirement of measure and per day factor of 0.85. This is consistent with this enforcement, with the enforcement policy for violations of existing enforcement orders, and it's consistent with other recent enforcement actions taken by this board. Collapsing days is not applicable for this violation since we are alleging less than 30 days. Staff calculated the initial liability to be $42,500. In step four of the enforcement policy, the enforcement policy required Water Board to consider adjustment of factors based on violators' conduct. For culpability and cleanup and cooperation, despite compliance assistance provided by staff, the respondent failed to comply with the actions and deadlines contained in the cleanup order, and similarly failed to cooperate with staff to clean up, to take any actions to resolve these violations. Thus, a value of 1.25 was appropriate for both factors. By multiplying values in steps 3 and 4, staff calculated the total base liability to be $66,406. The North Coast Water Board incurred a total of $3,404 in staff costs associated with this enforcement action. However, the prosecution team decided not to assess these costs against the respondent, as the total base liability already exceeds the maximum liability amount. Under step 8, I searched publicly available information to determine the respondent's ability to pay. Records, public records show the respondent owns the property, which has a total assessed value of $560,435. Additionally, records indicate that the respondent owned two other properties in Mendocino County with a combined total assessed value of $487,091. The value of each of these properties exceeds the proposed liability amount. On April 7, 2026, recently, CDFW forwarded to staff an email from Ms. Vargas indicating that the respondent had returned the property to the previous owners. The respondent has provided no evidence of transfer of ownership. On April 13, 2026, I contacted Mendocino County Recorder's Office and confirmed no transfer of ownership was recorded. The respondent had the opportunity throughout this proceeding to provide financial information and raise and substantiate an inability to pay argument, but failed to do so. Based on the information available, the prosecution team proposed no adjustment to the total base liability under this step. This table shows the minimum calculated and maximum liability amounts. The calculated liability amount in this case of the required actions of the cleanup and abatement order exceeds the maximum allowable liability amount and was adjusted to reflect the maximum liability amount to $50,000. Next. After adjusting to reflect the maximum liability amount, the final liability amount for the violation of required actions of the order was calculated to be $50,000. This concludes our prepared remarks. We have prepared a short closing statement. Would you like us to proceed to the closing statement, or you have questions?
Are there any questions from the board? Yes, Vice Chair McKenzie.
I'm curious as to the relationship of the translator, Ms. Vargas, to the respondent. Does she, do you regard her as legally able to respond to all the questions that have been asked?
Thank you, Vice Chair McKenzie. I'm Patrick Lewis. I'm staff counsel for the prosecution team. When Ms. Vargas reached out to us, she introduced herself as the sister-in-law of Mr. Sanchez Herrera. When we inquired as to, you know, his language preferences, she let us know that Spanish was his preferred language and that she was facilitating as an interpreter or translator for Mr. Sanchez Herrera. We wanted to know whether she was also acting as kind of a legal representative or agent in that capacity, and specifically asked her, are you working as an interpreter or are you an agent of Mr. Sanchez Herrera? She said that she was the interpreter and not an agent. So for purposes of this matter, at that point, we no longer considered her as someone that could act on his behalf or, you know, essentially anything that we could rely on as she was not his agent.
So essentially, Herrera has not been responding to us.
Correct.
Good. Thank you.
One of your first images, I think there was a rake laying on a pile of maybe trimmed leaves or something, but it gave me the impression that somebody was working and may have heard the trucks driving up and ran off to not be detected. It just seemed fresh. It didn't seem like it had been sitting there and got rained on or anything. So, I wonder the lack of communication and the failure to meet you on the site, it's possible this person is fearful of deportation or some other social activities that are going on in the world today. But did you ever get the feeling, go back a couple more, you're on the right track. One more. Oh, right there. So, sorry. But you see that next to the, you see that pile of trimmings that are there, and you see the knocked over bucket, and it just seems that, it's very possible that somebody could have been working there. And did you ever, when you were talking to Ms. Vargas, did you ever get the impression that this person was purposely avoiding you? I mean, she was the intermediary, but. This image makes me believe that there was somebody working there and ran off when they heard the trucks pull it up.
Go ahead and speak to.
Those are actively growing plants. They're
right.
Very,
somebody's tending those plants.
Exactly. Absolutely.
Yeah, and so it doesn't look abandoned, and I'm just surprised with the inspections that you never ran into anybody, literally, and just caught them out there working.
Well, I can speak to that in a much broader sense, and then Ermias can speak to his experience on the ground as the inspector, because I wasn't there. But programmatically, it's extremely common for nobody to be on site because people vacate properties when they see the caravan of vehicles coming. It's a criminal search warrant. Conducted by local law enforcement, or in this case, I believe Fish and Wildlife, or other law enforcement agencies. And so, this activity can be the subject of felonies. And, there are safety considerations that the greater inspection team takes into consideration, specifically for the instances when people literally flee on foot. Yeah, I think there's a known issue of avoiding being there on site during inspection. Then the second kind of question is, are people avoiding even engaging with us and interacting with us through this process? And I can't speak to that because I didn't have any direct interactions. But what I would just say is that regardless of, the reasons for avoiding engaging in the process, we still need to hold firm to implementing our cleanup abatement order and requiring cleanup because, frankly, whatever reasons they may have cannot be a shield for impacting water quality or the environment.
Okay, so my question kind of speaks more to the general process of these instances. At an site inspection, once you all go to leave, do you have a leave behind, and do you put it in various languages that whatever it is you're dealing with?
Yeah, we left a field notice at this location, and we included language translator later.
And you leave it in a very obvious site,
in
plain sight, sort of. You're not hiding it under a stump somewhere.
No, they usually we give them to the law enforcement who mm-hmm. were involved in that search operation. So they put it alongside with other documents. They put it there.
Great. Thank you.
Invisible areas where people, for instance, sometimes they post them in the door areas, and they are visible.
Okay. Thank you.
One other question. In the refuge pile you showed, you know, the garbage pile, was there any evidence of people living out there, cooking canisters, empty cans of food? It looked mostly like agricultural waste right there, but from the picture I couldn't tell. But then with that structure that's there, and as board member Bedoya said, those are plants that are requiring tending. So I'm wondering, you know, with all your site visits, it just strikes me that if somebody was living out there, there would be evidence of that. That's a lot of garbage.
Board Member Gisti, I don't know why it was one of our staff who inspected the property in September of 2025, and this trash, she took the photo of this trash, and she can testify on based on her observation of that site that day.
Good afternoon, members of the board. My name's Adona White. I'm an engineer on your staff. I have taken the oath. I did inspect on September 3rd, 2025. The property was replanted, and a second criminal search warrant was executed by California Department of Fish and Wildlife, and I was the inspector on site. This trash pile shown in the figure is located in front of that building you pointed out, Board Member Giusti, which is a garage building that had storage, water storage pools, and chemical storage, and essentially a garage structure. This was off to the front of it and adjacent to a trailer that was likely used for sleeping. Okay. And yes, this trash pile is a combination of household refuse as well as empty fertilizer bottles and cultivation-related plastics. And so it's a mixed pile.
Okay.
Thank you.
It's frustrating because given some of the other images that this team has showed us in the past, this isn't as bad as some of the images you've seen and even some of the other threats to water quality. And it's frustrating that people would rather run and hide than own up to what they need to do and create a bigger problem for themselves. So yeah, I just thank you. I appreciate the images and I appreciate your efforts.
Okay. Are there any further questions from the board?
Good.
Okay. Good. Great. Just confirming in the event in the last, 30 minutes or so that we've been having this hearing going, has the respondent made an appearance online? Emma?
I do not see the respondent online.
Okay. Are there any public comments in the room or online?
Not for this item.
Great. Well, then let's move into closing argument.
Bear with us, we're just getting our slide up. Compressed cleanup and abatement orders are an intentional and central part of the cannabis enforcement strategy used to accelerate compliance for simple remedial actions by issuing streamlined, focused orders that reduce processing time for both staff and cultivators to comply with. The respondent was engaged in illegal and unregulated cannabis cultivation that discharged and continues to threaten to discharge waste to an impaired watershed with sensitive habitats, necessitating a cleanup and abatement order. The respondent has failed to comply with the required actions of the cleanup and abatement order. So the prosecution team requests that the board adopt a proposed order and impose an administrative civil liability of $50,000 against the respondent for failing to implement the required cleanup actions. Thank you.
Madam Chair, question, clarify. So if this board was to adopt this ACL, how will the respondent be notified? Will they be notified that this action has been taken against them?
They will, consistent with our previous notification efforts, which they have confirmed receipt of our prior documents. So we will transmit the final order to them via mail, and presumably they would receive that and be able to respond to it.
Thank you.
I'm going to hold my question. Okay.
Will you entertain a motion?
I'm going to entertain a motion from the board to, on order number R12026-0028. Do I have a motion to?
Chair Hart.
I would move that.
Hold up. Yes, Bailey.
Before proceeding to that motion, I just have one small suggested proposal.
Okay.
If the board is considering adoption of the proposed order for the prosecution team, is just inclusion of citation to Water Code Section 13.323 in the order. It could be in the first paragraph that precedes the number finding, and then in the hereby ordered section. And that code section is speaks more broadly to the board's authority to impose administrative civil liability in addition to the specific code section cited.
Which section? 13.323.
323.
Okay. Do I have a motion to approve? Do we need to make this change to the draft, Bailey, before seeking a motion?
You could make it as part of the motion. So
okay.
The proposed order with that with that change.
So do I have a motion from the board to approve the order number R12026-0028 with the amended language inserted where appropriate about the inclusion of Water Code Section 13.323?
I so move.
Do I have a second? Take a roll call vote. Emma?
Board Member Bedoya?
Aye.
Board Member Giusti?
Before I vote, I just want Chair to know that I'm going to have a follow-up question for Council. I vote yes. Aye.
I wanted to just check in. I'm sorry to interrupt procedurally. I wanted to make sure that Chair referred to the correct order number.
Sorry, did I not?
I just want to make sure that it's accurate.
She said 0028.
Yeah,
is that the proposed order for this item?
Okay, then I got a bird in my ear. I just wanted to make sure that it was accurate. And I think, is that correct?
I think I heard 0028. Is that what you were reading
That was
from?
My intention.
Okay.
I sometimes
That's what
have
I
dyslexia take over in a
no,
moment.
I'm sorry. My guess is it may have been a difference between the complaint number and the order number. So thank you very much.
Do we continue with our roll call?
Board Member Romanini?
Aye.
Board Member Myers?
Oh, yes.
Vice Chair McKenzie?
Aye.
And Chair Hart?
Aye.
Madam Chair, this is a question for Council. Initially, when Kaysen was talking about the number of non-enrollees, I jotted down a question is, do we have a basic violation fee for non-enrollment? And what jumped in my mind was, you know, if you pull into a blue placard handicap parking space, minimum fine $250, or if you get caught driving in the diamond lane and you're not a true carpool, minimum fine of $450. Have we ever, is it even considerable to have a minimum fine for a non-enrollee as a basis from which to begin assessing liabilities? Is that even legal to consider down the road?
The process that I'm familiar with for failure to obtain waste discharge requirements or enroll in the permit would be under a separate water code section, and it would be the same process. I believe it's a smaller penalty amount for the statutory maximum, but I believe it is still the same ACL process and methodology. But if anybody else wants to add to that.
Well, just to add,
a failure to enroll in a permit after a request has been made to submit a report of waste discharge or enroll in the appropriate permit. Once that request is made, if the person doesn't satisfy that request, we can proceed, as Ms. Toft-Dupuy said, to administrative civil liability, but the maximum for those types of violations is $1,000 per day.
But might it be a leverage to get the word out that if you don't enroll, you're facing an automatic fine of $1,000 a day as an incentive to get people to take enrollment more seriously? So but people still drive in the diamond lane, right, and aren't carpools, but when you get caught, there's a consequence. And so if you get caught unrolled, I'm looking for a consequence.
Yeah, legally, statutorily, that penalty is available, and the board can pursue and has issued, you know, through the executive officer, directives to submit a report of waste discharge or enroll in the appropriate permit or face the potential penalties of $1,000 per day. So legally, it's an option. I think from a procedural standpoint and maybe a policy standpoint, the prosecution may have comments on why that route is not typically followed in cannabis cases.
And I'm not suggesting one or the other. I'm suggesting both. If it's a way to expedite compliance for people that you're thinking, well, I'm on their radar. It's going to cost me $1,000 to get on their radar and to start to interact. I'm just thinking of not a one or the other, but an opportunity to use both mechanisms as a way to incentivize compliance.
Board Member Juicy, can I speak to your question as well, real briefly? So one of the terms that you've heard both my colleagues use today is prosecutorial discretion. That is a hard word, isn't it? So under the Water Code, the region has numerous authorities or numerous statutes that it could seek to enforce for a plethora of violations that we see at these cannabis cultivation sites. One of those, like your counsel mentioned, is for a failure to enroll when there was a discharge, essentially. And another one of these statutes is the ones that you guys are hearing today, which is the 13304, the Cleanup and Abatement Authority. Now, there's certain hurdles and levers that have to be cleared for assessing any type of violation. However, you know, as far as using the prosecutorial discretion, the prosecution team decided on specifically seeking a cleanup and abatement order, as it gives the team an opportunity to have the environmental impacts remediated at the site. Whereas if you were just to enforce on the failure to enroll in the cannabis general order, that's a much smaller violation penalty, and there are more hurdles that we have to jump through, and we're not going to be able to order with our authority, with the board's authority, the cleanup of the property. So when we look at these properties and we think prosecutorial discretion, we look at, you know, the cannabis enforcement strategy that the board has adopted and which of the tools in the Water Code is best suited to help us address the situation at the property. Now, that can be different in different scenarios. Say there are a property with significant discharges. We've had a hillside fail and wash into a waterway, right? We have authority under the Water Code to immediately assess violations for that discharge as opposed to ordering the cleanup. So kind of big picture is the prosecution team is looking at all of these Water Codes authorities and violations and looking at what we could assess in the specific situation and what tool we think is best.
Yeah, I think you're overthinking it. If you find somebody that's got a commercial cannabis grow and there is not a single water quality violation, they're still in violation of not being enrolled. Is that correct?
That's correct.
So what would you do? Would you walk away there? No, I'm suggesting that you still have an opportunity to leverage compliance by leveling a $1,000 fine simply for not being enrolled. And I don't care if the place, you know, you can eat off the floor. They're not enrolled. And that could be a hook to get more people interested in becoming compliant.
I really appreciate that, Board Member Giusti, and I appreciate your perspective that it's not an either or in terms of which water code authority we use, that it's kind of like, let's do both. And I will point out that the enforcement strategy that we already have in place does speak to what you're saying. We have identified the authority that we use today in this case as one of our primary strategy elements because we are intending to prioritize site cleanup as kind of our
I understand that.
Environmental restoration as our primary goal. I think it's strategy number 3 or 4 we've identified as supporting strategy, which means it's on the table. And what I'm hearing today is that we should, you know, reconsider doing that at a broader scale, because enrollment enforcement in permissive counties is one of our strategies. Procedurally and logistically, it has some additional hurdles, but what I appreciate your support, and what I'm hearing is that we should look into that. So I'll just leave it at that.
Let's leave it at that.
Thank you.
Oh, Nate, were you wanting to say something? Nope. You look like you'd started leaning towards that mic.
Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't have anything else.
Okay. All right. Any other follow-up from board members? Great. We're going to take a 15-minute break. We'll be back at whatever that time makes it. Okay. Welcome back to our next agenda item, which would be agenda item 4, the public hearing for administrative civil liability complaint number R12026-0009, issued to Pedro Martinez Garcia. Let staff go ahead and come up and get set up. Once you're set up, I'll read our instructions.
Madam Chair, while they're setting up, everybody will be very pleased to know that Arsenal has gone through to the semifinals of the European Champions League. I just wanted you all to know that. Thank you.
Staff, are you good to go?
We're ready.
Okay, here we go. This is the time and place for a public hearing to consider issuance of an order for administrative civil liability to Jorge Sanchez Herrera. Wait.
No.
No.
No. This is number 4. This is Pedro Martinez Garcia.
Staff, I have a duplicate copy of names here in this order. Sorry. Okay, here, hold on. Hold on. Okay, got a typo. All right. This is the time and place for a public hearing to consider issuance of an order for administrative civil liability to Pedro Martinez Garcia for the violation alleged in administrative civil liability complaint number R12026-0009. The complaint alleges violations of a cleanup and abatement order related to a site in Mendocino County. The complaint seeks penalties of $50,000 for violation of Water Code Section 13304. This hearing will be conducted in accordance with the hearing procedure that was issued with the complaint and instructions provided today. In this matter, we have separated the functions of staff between those who are acting in a prosecutorial role and will be presenting the proposed order, complaint, and evidence for this board's consideration, and those who will advise the board in its consideration of this material or of this matter. All parties are subject to the same applicable rules and regulations, including the prohibition on ex parte communications with board members and the advisory team. The advisory team for this matter includes the board's executive officer, Valerie Quinto, and counsel to the board, Nate Jacobson, and Bailey Toft-Dupuy. Did I nail it? Yeah. The prosecution team and other parties will introduce themselves as the hearing proceeds. This hearing is being conducted both in person and via video conference. During this hearing, the board will consider relevant evidence and testimony to decide whether to issue an order assessing the proposed liability, issue a modified order assessing a higher or lower amount, or to reject the proposed liability. The prosecution team has submitted a proposed order for the board's consideration. Generally, the order of the hearing will be as follows. Parties' opening statements, prosecution team's case presentation and direct testimony for witnesses, cross-examination for prosecution witnesses, respondent, Garcia case presentation and direct testimony from witnesses, cross-examination of Mr. Garcia's witnesses, prosecution's rebuttal and Mr. Garcia's rebuttal as necessary, closing arguments, public comments, if any, following the conclusion of the party's cases. Any members of the public wishing to give non-evidentiary policy statements will have 5 minutes to do so. The board may meet in closed session to deliberate on this matter. Is the respondent, Garcia, in attendance here today?
Nope. They are not on Zoom either.
Great. Thank you, Emma. Then we will proceed with the preceding outline I just read. We will just go directly into public comments following the prosecution's case and board discussion. So do any of the parties have any questions on the general order of proceedings?
We do not.
Great. Okay. Each witness that the parties intend to call will be required to take an oath. For those planning to give testimony, please stand and take the following oath. Do you swear the testimony you are about to give is the truth?
Yes.
Great, thank you. Prior to testifying, please state your name, affiliation, and whether you have taken the oath. As was stated in the hearing procedure, each party will be allowed a total of 30 minutes. Neither party requested additional time, and the parties may use their time as they choose. I may modify these procedures and time allocations as needed and upon request and for good cause. Board members or members of the advisory team may ask questions at any time. The timer will stop for procedural discussions, questions from the board members or the advisory team, and other causes such as technical issues. The timer will show time left to each party. Any other matters from the parties or the advisory team before we begin?
No.
Great. Prosecution, your floor.
Good afternoon. Good afternoon, Chair Hart, members of the board. Again, I'm Casey Grady of your staff, and I've taken the oath. I supervise the Agriculture and Enforcement Division, here again with another administrative civil liability complaint resulting from noncompliance with a cleanup and abatement order associated with unlicensed cannabis cultivation for your consideration. I am part of the prosecution team that issued the complaint to the respondent, Pedro Martinez Garcia, and I'm here with our with Claudia Villacorta, our assistant executive officer and lead prosecutor, Brian Fuller, our cannabis program enforcement specialist and engineering geologist to my left, and lead technical staff for this case. I'm also here with Heather Jitkoff to my left and McKenna Miles in the audience, our counsels from the Office of Enforcement. My presentation will be a little shorter due to less background on the strategy. During today's presentation, the prosecution team will provide a very brief overview of our cannabis regulatory program and enforcement strategy as they relate to this case, followed by an overview of the location, characteristics, and conditions of the property that a cleanup and abatement order was issued to address. We will also present a chronology of the various enforcement actions and attempts at communication with the respondent. We will then discuss in more detail the violation the prosecution team is alleging. Then we'll provide a brief overview of the liability and adjustments and calculations that justify the proposed liability. As I just reviewed in the last case, commercial cannabis cultivators in California are required to enroll in the State Water Board's Cannabis Cultivation General Waste Discharge Requirements, along with lake and stream bed alteration agreements with the Department of Fish and Wildlife county permits and licenses to cultivate from the Department of Cannabis Control. They must comply with the cannabis cultivation policy, pay annual fees, submit site management plans, and submit monitoring reports. The respondent was not enrolled in the regulatory program, and as we'll show, he did not conduct his commercial operation in a manner that was protective of water quality. He gained an economic advantage by avoiding to pay for permitting fees, hiring qualified professionals, or implement site improvements to protect water quality. This case aligns with our cannabis program's enforcement strategy to pursue expedited action at unregulated cultivation sites. We issued a streamlined cleanup and abatement order focused on straightforward remedial measures. The respondent failed to comply with those, and we are now prioritizing penalty assessment for that violation. On a criminal search warrant, your staff documented unauthorized cannabis cultivation without a license from the Department of Cannabis Control and without coverage under the Water Board's Cannabis General Order. This board issued a cleanup and abatement order, which the respondent failed to comply with, and has been unresponsive to your staff throughout this process. As previously noted, the cannabis enforcement strategy contemplates timely issuance of a complaint in response to violations of cleanup and abatement orders. Based on the facts of this case, we estimated approximately 10 days would have been needed to prepare the complaint. Accordingly, the prosecution team exercised prosecutorial discretion and proposed a $50,000 penalty for 10 days of violation for the respondent's failure to clean up his property, as demonstrated by his failure to provide photographic confirmation of cleanup and disposal receipts. Mr. Brian Fuller, our Cannabis Program Enforcement Specialist, will now present an overview of the site, the conditions at the property that the cleanup and abatement order was issued to address, and the evidence and our rationale to support the proposed penalty. Thank you.
Thank you for the introduction, Kaysen, and thank you, members of the board, for hearing our case. My name is Brian Fuller, and I have taken the oath. I am a licensed professional geologist and a member of your staff as the Cannabis Program Enforcement Specialist, as part of the Agriculture and Enforcement Division. In addition to my oral testimony today, I prepared the written declaration submitted as Exhibit 24. I affirm the testimony contained in that declaration is true and correct. This map shows the location of the property where the respondent was commercially cultivating cannabis without authorization, leading to the issuance of a cleanup and abatement order, which is the basis of our complaint. The property is marked by a red star on this map and is located east of the Round Valley Reservation in the northern edge of Mendocino County. This map is a zoomed-in view of the property location. The property borders the southern bank of Shell Rock Creek, which is tributary to the Eel River. Unmapped tributaries to Shell Rock Creek pass through the property. The respondent purchased the property on May 18, 2016. Aerial imagery presented in Exhibit 7 demonstrates that the respondent commercially cultivated cannabis on the property between 2017 and 2025. On August 12, 2025, I inspected the property during the service of a criminal search warrant. During the inspection, I observed cannabis cultivation activities discharging and threatening to discharge waste to receiving waters. The image on the left shows a greenhouse next to the head of a water course. Nutrients and pollution from the greenhouse threatens to discharge to the headwater stream. Trash is also visible in this headwater stream. These pollutants threaten to discharge to higher order streams during precipitation events. The image to the right shows waste potting soil located above a headwater stream. The fine sediment and excess nutrients in the imported soils are susceptible to being transported into the stream network during precipitation events. The image on the left shows an unpermitted stream impoundment constructed with plastic sheeting. In addition to taking the cool water from the stream network, plastic waste from the diversion threatens to transport downstream. An arrow in the top left of the image identifies the location of a pump pictured in the image to the right. Spilled petroleum products are visible below the pump, which threatens to discharge into the stream. Here, the image on the left shows cannabis plant waste disposed of in a tributary to Shell Rock Creek. The plant material may seem innocuous, but we often find illegal pesticides, like those shown in the previous item, applied to the plants. And so on these unauthorized sites, we really don't know what's on the plants. The image on the right shows burned plastic waste in a water course. This activity can also introduce chemical pollutants into the watershed. I made those observations on August 12, 2025, and I left a field notice on site with my contact information. On September 24th, I transmitted a notice of observed water quality violations, a report with my observations, and a draft cleanup order with an invitation for the respondent to provide comments on the draft. The envelope included a letter printed in 10 languages that offered language service from the State Water Board's Office of Public Participation, Equity, and Tribal Affairs. These letters were delivered to the respondent's P.O. box on September 27th, and he signed receipt for these letters at the property on September 30th and at his P.O. box on October 10th. We received no response. So on October 15th, the executive officer issued a final cleanup and abatement order with the same deadline for required actions that was presented in the draft that the respondent signed receipt for on September 30th. The cleanup order that was issued is what we are calling a streamlined cleanup order. It requires the respondent to remove all of the cannabis cultivation waste from the riparian setbacks, properly dispose of refuse, solid wastes, and all hazardous waste to a waste disposal facility authorized to accept that type of waste, and submit disposal receipts and photographic confirmation to the North Coast Water Board. The compressed cleanup order does not require technical reports, permits from the North Coast Water Board, or work performed by a licensed professional. On October 15th, 2025, we mailed one copy of the final cleanup order to the property using GLS, and a second copy to the respondent's P.O. box using U.S. Postal Service's regular mail. Delivery of the first copy to the property was not successful via GLS, and although the USPS mailing of the second copy was likely delivered to the respondent's P.O. box because it was not returned to us, there was no tracking information for this delivery method, so we mailed a third copy with USPS certified mail on November 4th and a fourth copy with priority mail to the respondent's P.O. box on November 14th. All of these mailings included a copy of the Language Services flyer. The priority mailing of the cleanup order arrived at the respondent's P.O. box on November 17th, and the respondent signed receipt of the final cleanup and abatement order at his post office on December 6th. On November 20th, staff also transmitted the cleanup order with a notice of violation letter explaining the respondent's risk of liability if he failed to comply with the order. This letter again included a copy of the Language Service flyer. The notice of violation was delivered to the respondent's post office box on December 4th, and the respondent signed receipt for the notice of violation on December 6th. The respondent failed to respond to any of these attempts at communication, so the assistant executive officer issued this complaint on January 16th. So the violation we're alleging the respondent violated Water Code Section 13304 by failing to implement required action in the cleanup order. 10 days of violation are alleged between November 18th, the first day following the track delivery of the cleanup and abatement order, and November 27th. Water Code Section 13350 allows for up to $5,000 per day of violation of a cleanup and abatement order and requires a minimum liability of $100 per day of violation. We follow the penalty methodology included in the State Water Board's enforcement policy, which applies factors related to the potential of harm to the regulatory program, deviation from requirements, culpability, history of violations, and cleanup and participation of the respondent. This resulted in a base liability greater than the maximum liability of $5,000 per day. The enforcement policy also allows for recuperating staff costs, which for the period between the deadline of the cleanup and order and issuance of the complaint totaled $5,375. However, the base liability amount for this complaint exceeds the maximum liability, so the prosecution team did not assess these costs against the respondent. The enforcement policy also considers the respondent's ability to pay. In this case, we have no indication that the respondent lacks the ability to pay the liabilities. The respondent has had abundant opportunities to engage with us and provide information about his finances, including revenues and liabilities, but he has failed to do so. The only information we have is the value of the property, which was assessed at $420,501 in 2025. So staff did not recommend making any adjustments to the liability based on the ability to pay. So, following the enforcement policy, the proposed liability is equal to the maximum liability, $50,000. And that concludes my presentation, but I have prepared a closing statement if the board would like to hear that now or if there are any questions.
Are there any questions from the board?
This grower had 8 years of production?
That's an estimate from aerial imagery. So you can look at the aerial imagery, see the greenhouses there. But this was, I believe, the first time that there was a criminal search warrant served on the property.
Okay. I was just going to ask, why did it take so long to find them?
It's in a very remote location.
Okay. Thank you.
Madam Chair, I'm curious about the 10 days. And I was reading in the summary of violation that they, based on the facts and alleged violation in this case, the prosecution team determined that 10 days would have been an appropriate amount of time to issue the complaint. But then there seems to be some consideration of this board's meeting schedule, and other matters, and yet, if you look at it from another point of view, the violations have been going on, you could argue, for 10 months or 10 months plus. And it just seems to me that this 10 days is a somewhat artificial. I mean, is it within our ability to say, well, it was 20 days or 30 days, and therefore it was, not the amount that you're proposing of $50,000, but $150,000, a more significant penalty?
So in terms of what the board can consider today, because the complaint that was issued only alleged 10 days and is based on the prosecution's determination that 10 days was the appropriate period,
right.
The board couldn't change that time range today because that's how the complaint was issued.
Now, I understand from that point of view, and I'm sort of looking, shall we say, more philosophic, you know, the philosophy of enforcement in these matters where evidently cannabis has been grown and presumably the grower has profited from the sale of cannabis, or one might argue the illegal sale of cannabis at some time, for 6 years. Large sums of money compared to $50,000. So this is a question basically of our cannabis enforcement policy and how come you get this 10-day business.
Well, I can kind of respond to, you know, what supports in this case, you know, our issuance and decision to proceed with a penalty for 10 days of violation. And, you know, in this instance, Brian came back from his inspection. We prioritized a cleanup abatement order. And when they violated that cleanup abatement order, we looked at the facts of the case. We met to prioritize a complaint expeditiously, consistent with the with our strategy. And in this instance, the violation was very simple. You know, the streamlined compressed cleanup abatement order that we've been talking about is very straightforward. Very simple remedial actions, you know, very easy to comply with. And so when somebody doesn't comply with it, it's simple to move forward. And with simple violations to allege, we can proceed with a complaint more quickly. It's a simpler document to produce. And so, you know, we effectively were able to produce a complaint within approximately 10 days. There gets to be another part of the question, which this is not just why we allege 10 days, but then maybe why didn't we issue the complaint so quickly if we were able to produce it so quickly? And that gets into those other factors that were described in the package, which, you know, the board hearing schedule is set. And there's statutory obligations to issue a penalty or complaints within 90 days of a hearing. And at the time that at the end of the year in November, when we were considering that, the next hearing was in February. And so it was infeasible with the hearing procedures, the standard hearing procedures, to make February. So then we waited till the next hearing on the agenda. We could, absolutely, we have the discretion and the flexibility to allege more days. And I think with the board's support for these types of cases, for alleging more days, we could take that into consideration for future cases. I would also say for this case, barring an action by the board, you know, today, the violations do continue. And so additional complaints could be brought for this case and other cases if that were to be a priority. I think that was most of what I had to say in response. Okay.
Madam Chair, I'm, you know, had some experience in US EPA and pesticide enforcement matters, and thinking about the deterrent effect of our enforcement actions on other illegal cannabis growers. And I don't have an intimate knowledge of cannabis business, but it does seem to me that $50,000 may be regarded as somewhat de minimis in terms of a penalty. I'm curious if, through you, Madam Chair, if the executive officer or counsel has any comment on that, just the philosophy of enforcement against illegal cannabis activities.
Well, I will say that while $50,000 is less than some other penalties that have come before the board, it is a, you know, I personally still consider it a significant penalty. I also think in the history of our board, I have perceived in advising the board that at times the board has had, or certain board members have had, sticker shock with really large penalties in cases like these that were for noncompliance with a cleanup and abatement order. And so I think as advisory, it would certainly help me if, you know, if the board, as the board is evolving and we have, you know, different membership, it would help me as an advisor to the board to know if there's if the board has a different inclination in terms of appetite for larger penalties with regard to these actions where the alleged violations are noncompliance with the cleanup order.
Madam Chair, just for the record, I do not have sticker shock.
Duly noted, Vice Chair. Yes.
Well, I'll weigh in. My opinion is the fine should reflect the amount of pollution potential, the amount of grading and level of illegal activity. Yes, they're growing weed. Yes, they've graded, but every county is different, and I think personally the fine is sufficient, sends a message. But if there were, oh, I don't know, a ton of pesticides out there with the potential to spill, then yeah, I'd increase the motivator.
Madam Chair, just to chime in, Board Member McKenzie, you know, whether it's 50,000 or 500,000, we're never going to see a dime of anything. I mean, that's the reality of this. So I getting back to my earlier comments, again, in the amount of time, even though this is an expedited process, which I like, and I don't want to make any changes, but it's still almost 2 years, right? A year and a half of effort.
So we inspected this site in August of last year. So it was, okay. It's been less than a year, and we gave deadlines as quick as possible for October, or I think the cleanup and abatement order deadlines were in November. So
that is pretty yeah. quick compared yeah. to what we've seen in the past. And again, to even expedite it more, getting back to my argument before, given the risk to water quality on this particular case and the chances of seeing any money, whether it's 50,000 or 500,000, a citation, a quick citation of a minimum fine to get, at least try and get them in the door if it's more realistic. This is so big, they're going to walk away, is my opinion. I hope I'm wrong, but whether it's $50,000 or $10,000 for the state of California, it's not much, right? For an individual, $50,000 I think would get somebody's attention, whether they can pay it or not. Mm-hmm. So, and there's a lot of subjectivity. Was it 1.25, 1.62, you know, in your subjective assessment of assessing risk with your calculator. So there's a lot of wiggle room in all of this. And I think personally I'd like to what this board discussed for in length and what you presented, how you wanted to proceed, and it seems to be working for your staff. I'd like to leave it the way it is for a while. That would be my personal opinion. Then keep doing it this way and keep shooting for less than a year to try and resolve these issues. But again, I don't want fines to just make people walk away, because they're going to do that without much incentive. We've seen that.
Before I jump in and kind of give my take on this, Board Member Myers or Romanini, do you want to make go up, please?
Yeah, you're in both these presentations. You mentioned the financial assessment, their ability to pay. What kind of process do you go through? What process do you go about how you determine the financial ability for them to pay?
My understanding, it's primarily the respondent's burden to make that argument. So we were limited without any input from them, and we solely looked at the value of the property that we knew they had. And with that being greater, that was the limit to our investigation of their ability to pay.
All right, thank you.
I agree with a lot of what's been set up here, even though it's kind of coming from different points of view. Board Member Giusti's right. I mean, we're not going to see a dime of this, and it's about cleaning up the site and what's best for that environment. That's what we're here to do. And I think at your all's discretion and expertise, I mean, just looking back at the map, your slide with the map, this is an extremely remote area, but, you know, consideration of how close is it to a main stem? You know, it's pretty, I mean, straight as crow flies, and I don't know what that would be, what that scale is roughly, to the Eel River, mile length to the river. It's pretty close. So, you know, what's that, I don't know, what's that balance between what's a big sticker item and what's not a big sticker item? If you're 20 miles from the Eel, or name one of your big main stems, okay, maybe you're not going to go levy a $500,000 fine. But if you're close to a main stem where we're talking about some really vital habitats that we're looking to help improve for, you know, anadromous fish, Molly, you can speak to this and if I'm off base on this, but I think use a bigger stick the closer to the main stem you are. Clean your act up, no pun intended. So, yeah, that's my take on that. Okay.
I just wanted to add one other point to the dollar amount and the difficulty in collecting on penalties. And the reality is that, yeah, we rarely, in cases such as this where a party doesn't appear at the hearing, hasn't been engaged, once the penalty is issued, we don't have a high probability of collecting on that payment. And so then the next step is to get a money judgment in court and then attach a lien to the property for that amount. And so in this case, in the prior case, if the board adopts an order here, $50,000. One practical consequence of that is that that's a lien on the property. And so for a person, a subsequent purchaser to come in that may want to do cleanup activity, they will have to satisfy that lien. And so a very large lien may make the property not particularly marketable.
Can I have a follow-up question on that? Sure. Maybe before I do that, Valerie, to get your take on this, maybe do I hold, because this, it seems like we're kind of getting into theory on our process of this whole deal versus the case in front of us at the moment. Should we maybe move ahead with a decision on this case and then come back to this, because I have a follow-up question on that, but I also have a couple other general comments to go with this.
I think it would be better to keep this item open and have the conversation in the context of this hearing rather than following this hearing to have a general conversation about strategy, because It isn't on the agenda to have that general discussion, but we can have the discussion in the context of this hearing. So
okay.
I think, yeah.
Well, then I'll go ahead with my question. So in a theoretical case, so you get the lien on the property, but you do have a potential buyer that wants to come in and remediate the site. I mean, is there a mechanism within our own processes to, if we know we have someone coming in the door saying, hey, I want to clean this up, could we, for lack of a better term, get rid of the lien? Because I'd rather them pay that fine instead of paying a fine to us that just goes wherever it goes. I'd rather they pay that amount and clean the site up. And if that is you can turn a carrot into the stick a little bit, yeah. Right? Do we have that ability?
Yeah, it's a good question. It's not something that that we've done before. We haven't pursued it. But if the board, you know, if the board wished to extinguish the lien on the property, we could do that. The board could make that request. We'd have to think through legally what would happen to that debt then. There's some further considerations that would have to take place. And so I don't have an answer for you today, but yeah.
Okay. I'll just put these were general questions I was going to have that not relating to this issue that we've been discussing, but first of all, I really love the inclusion of the staff costs. I wish we had that on almost everything we were doing. That's really helpful information, I think, for the public. And then this is a question for this type of, I don't know, this has come up on other civil liability complaint presentations, not just today. And it seems to be most consistent across the, I don't know, most of the time this is the case, but there's been a few, this second one today, we didn't have it. But looking at the value of the assessed or the property in question, we have the assessed value presented. But then other times we have the assessed value of all the property owned by the respondents. And I just, maybe that's just policy. Maybe it's not stipulated. I don't know. It makes me really uncomfortable seeing when you have all the respondents' properties, even property that has nothing to do with what's on, you know, the on-site, the subject, I call it subject, my nomenclature is an appraiser, the subject site, you looking at the assessed value of that, I think is absolutely appropriate. If the fine is larger than that assessed value, okay, then go look at additional properties into your calculus. But presenting all a respondent's owned properties in a presentation that has, you know, I have trouble. What is the policy? Do you guys know?
There's no policy about that. I think that we look at available public records with regards to determining somebody's ability to pay, but I appreciate the nuance that what I'm hearing is there's no need to disclose that publicly in a presentation if the proposed penalty is less than the asset value of the property in discussion.
Correct. That's exactly what I'm getting at. And not to say that you guys can't look at it and keep it in your work file, but we don't need to air everyone's dirty laundry here in public. So, and then lastly, just congrats. I do congratulate you on how quickly this has come before us. I think that was our original intention back at the meeting where we approved this. I remember it was in Yreka. I don't remember the date.
December 24.
That one. So this is exactly what we wanted. We need, you know, speeding this whole process up. But my question here, is there a reason you don't start out with signed delivery from the get-go versus, because you guys, I think if I recall correctly, you sent out 4 separate. That's a lot of shots. Can we get to the punch and do one? I don't know if that, just a thought.
Part of the, we're moving so quickly that we don't know where to find the individuals when we issue our first attempts at communication. And so it starts on the inspection in August.
Mm-hmm.
We have no knowledge of the property owner or where they may be before that. And so we send the letters where we think they may be. And we initially try sign
delivery.
Delivery, yeah.
Yeah, I'm splitting hairs on this, but it was something that stood out to me in your presentation. Like, wow, that's a lot of attempts here. The first one, sure, do it polite, but maybe then the second one, say, signed order and let's move.
The one nuance about signed orders is sometimes when people receive that green card, they'll refuse it. So just starting with that or relying on that does not solve all of our delivery issues. So we still, I think, in the end, find that we have to be thorough, and we will be thorough. That's the hard part of the process.
I get you. Great. Okay. Thank you. Any other comments? Yes, Vice Chair McKenzie.
I'm just curious, under the regulatory considerations, number 27, the North Coast Water Board or delegated officer is authorized to refer this matter to the Office of the Attorney General for collection or other enforcement if the respondent fails to comply with payment of the administrative civil liability. What's our relationship with the Attorney General's office? Are they anxious to proceed with matters on which we've deliberated?
Well, we do have a relationship with the Attorney General's office. They represent us in court. We are their client. In terms of pursuing debt amounts, there is, there are limitations in terms of resources. And so oftentimes if it's going to be a lot of resources for a low dollar amount, we're going to end up in the red. We're throwing good money after bad. And so it may not be worth a referral, but absolutely, the Attorney General's office can represent us in collections proceedings and assisting with payment.
And this is a more technical question, I guess. But do we have any knowledge of Mr. Herrera or Mr. Garcia's actual personal wealth, if you will, their ability to pay a $50,000 fine?
Because they've, in this specific case, Mr. Martinez Garcia has failed to engage with us at all and provide any private information about his finances. We are left to rely on the publicly available information, which is the value of his property asset, which arguably we could have included more properties had he owned them. So he only owns the one property, to our knowledge.
He may own other properties, but yeah. We didn't pursue that information.
But my question is, doesn't he have personal wealth as a result of selling cannabis for 6 years, if I heard correctly? Surely there's personal wealth as well as property.
And we have, I'm not aware of ways to discover that without his involvement.
That's why I'm interested in the Attorney General's involvement in such matters.
It's a good point. And the Attorney General's office can assist with certain forensic type activities, seeking where, looking where someone has assets and bank accounts and other assets. So that is a role that they can assist in. Yeah.
And again, I come back to deterrence. Deterrence to other people who are illegally operating. But I've said my piece already.
Board Member McKenzie, just to add to your comments, I do recall at least one time when we referred a case to the Attorney General. It was incredibly convoluted with multiple players involved, as opposed to this one is really clean and straightforward. Yeah. But there was one that, when it was being explained to us, it was overwhelmingly complex, and we needed more resources at a higher level. So this board has done that in the past for that particular case, which was much, much different than what's before us today.
Yeah, Madam Chair, it just seems to me at the very least that if this board believes in what we're doing, then at least we should refer to a higher authority. And I'm obviously have an interest in the whole philosophy of enforcement, coming at least in part of my career from an enforcement background. So I'll just leave it at that at the moment. But I think it would be interesting for this board to have a discussion about enforcement and to hear from the staff what their sense is. I mean, I'm talking from up here in the dais, but I'm not out in the field doing the actual work or the actual enforcement. So, Madam Chair, that would be my request that sometime in the future, the not too distant future.
We do bring an annual enforcement update to board members, an update on our enforcement priorities. And, each year we kind of shape that to try to have some different interesting element. And I'm not sure yet if if Jeremiah, as our enforcement coordinator, if he has yet come up with a theme for that presentation, but that might be something for us to consider tacking onto that if it fits within. Yeah, if Jeremiah doesn't already have something equally exciting for us.
And it hadn't escaped my notice, Madam Chair, that there's now six of us sitting up there here, and no doubt there may be even a seventh. We may have a full board, and I don't know when the last time that ever happened, but it would seem to me that the opportunity is coming up to get Jeremiah put his thinking cap on and present to us and give us something to chew on.
Jeremiah, you're sitting in the back nodding your head. You're taking notes, I'm sure. There you go. Perfect.
Thank you, Jeremiah. Thank you, board member.
Okay, with that, are there any other comments from the board? Great.
Chair, yes. Gerard. Just for your consideration, similar to the earlier order, I would suggest the board including a citation to Water Code Section 13.323 in the hereby ordered section. It's ordered pursuant to that section as well.
Great. Before I call for a motion, I want to double check Emma one last time. Is the respondent, Garcia, made an appearance online?
No, they have not.
Okay. With that, do I have a motion on the board for proposed order number R12026-0027?
I will so move with the addition of
Council Water Code Section 13.323.
And I so move.
Okay. Do I have a second?
Second.
Let's have a vote, please.
Board Member Bedoya?
Aye.
Board Member Giusti?
Aye.
Board Member Romanini?
Aye.
Board Member Myers?
Aye.
Vice Chair McKenzie?
Aye.
Chair Hart?
Aye. Okay, moving on. Executive officers.
By the way, Madam Chair, thank you to staff for the diligence and the speed. Good job.
Yes, I second that. Moving on to executive officers report. Valerie, I'll leave the floor to you.
Okay. Thank you. I don't have anything to report today in addition to the written report, but I did want to highlight one thing in the written report that you received, and that is an update on the Laguna de Santa Rosa Reconciliation Project, which is a project that's been on our docket a long time and has previously been referred to as the Laguna de Santa Rosa TMDL project. Really just wanted to highlight an exciting development in that project, which is that the City of Santa Rosa has, in partnership with our staff, is taking the lead on forming a task force explore possibilities for reconciliation of the watershed. So really getting an in-depth facilitated interdisciplinary conversation about how to address the very, very complex and large water quality issues in that watershed. So my understanding is that they're still working to identify a consultant to convene that group. But really excited to have the city's partnership on that effort and looking forward to reporting out to the board more as that process develops and as we determine more what that reconciliation project will look like. Thank you.
Great. Board member requests for future agenda items and other items of interest. Any requests from the board?
I've got a couple. Just follow up on the hatcheries permit and any changes happening there, and then the sediment coming out of Lake Mendocino, Coyote Dam, and how the Army Corps is addressing it.
Okay, well, first off, I am pleased to report that we are planning a field trip as part of our October board meeting to the Fall Creek Hatchery, which is up actually in the area of Klamath Dam removal and restoration. And that's the facility that was reopened as part of that project in place of Iron Gate Hatchery. So that field trip, the idea for that was inspired by your requests, Board Member Bedoya. Beyond that, I don't have anything to report about updates to the hatchery permit. That's currently, renewal of that permit is currently, I think, a couple years out on our schedule at this point. But our staff have been in close contact with hatchery staff, including that individual that you communicated with, to make sure we understand the nature of their concerns and how those are impacting their operations so that we can better inform the permit update.
And I'll go on record to explain that conversation. I was interested in the in finding out what the justification for Department of Fish and Game's stocking the Sacramento River with salmon smolt when it coincided with the striped bass run. So it just didn't make sense. And so that prompted my call to the biologists, which led to conversations and their request for some kind of permit relief. Mm-hmm. And that's all they said.
Yes. Yes. Thank you for clarifying that. Sorry, I threw that out there flippantly about your contact with their staff. But thank you for your ongoing interest in that. And I am excited to get us all out together to visit that hatchery. It's a good one. I've gotten to visit it myself before, so I think you'll all enjoy it. I don't have anything new to report on Coyote Valley Dam, but I anticipate that I will soon, imminently.
I attended the Steelhead Festival up in Healdsburg on the Warm Springs Dam, and spoke with a Army Corps of Engineer individual staffer and asked them the question. We were having a conversation there with Bob Coey from NOAA Fisheries, and I asked him, "Well, are you guys working on this sediment problem?" And he said, "Yes, we're working on it." But that's as far as the conversation went.
Yes. I mean, and certainly there's a good amount of public information in the 2025 biological opinion about the efforts that the Corps of Engineers is undertaking related to turbidity. But with regard to any regional board action, I don't have anything to share at present, but hope to soon.
Thank you. Board members, are there any other requests for future agenda items?
Not a request, but Valerie, do I remember you saying we will be getting an update on the National Rivers project that is it Trout Unlimited is doing?
Outstanding National Resource Waters, yes, led by Matt St. John, right, of our staff in partnership with NGOs, including CalTrout and Trout Unlimited. We do have an update scheduled for that, and I'm going to see if SharePoint will work quickly for me to find our schedule and make sure I speak correctly to the date of that. We are planning that update for also in October, up in Wairika on the day before the hatchery tour.
Thank you. And thanks for following up on that. Appreciate it.
Of course. Thank you.
If not for the public comment made today by Mr. Matt Green, I'm glad he made the comment, because it's something that is just, I'm almost getting sick and tired of hearing the question. Can staff do a presentation this calendar year on what a technical advisory group is and how it is selected? Can we do that, please? I think it's between the Vineyard Order, the Lily Bulbs, and our other orders. It creates so much frustration, and it seems like we finally get to the point where actual draft of whatever permit is being presented, and there's so much misinformation that comes out of these tag groups. And it just, I don't know. I think it would be good for the public, at least allow the opportunity, the public, the opportunity to hear what it is a tag group is. So maybe we can put to rest some things that occur.
Mm-hmm. That's a great question. I'll briefly say that I think those groups can take a little bit of a different form and structure depending on the project. With regard to the Wallala project that Matt mentioned, our staff are very well aware of the confusion and are working to dispel that and make things much more clear. And so we can provide an update on that, you know, in addition to the work our staff are doing to share that information with interested parties. We can do that at a board meeting. It may not be substantive enough to put it as an info item on the agenda. It may be something just to, you know, to provide a less formal update about.
Yeah.
But either way, we agree that there's some consternation, and we're eager to help clarify that for everyone involved, including and board members.
Just speaking, I mean, I recall during the Vineyard Order, the amount of comments from various folks just... The claims about what the tag group is and what's occurring during the tag meetings, like, it just created, and that problem seems to be replicated mm-hmm. across all these other permits. So, I don't know what the best way to do it, but I think we need to just address this finally in mm-hmm. person. Like, okay, what is it this thing is? What are tag groups? Here it is. Move on.
Yeah. Great point. I think we can do that. I think it will come up with regard to specific projects when the board has an adoption hearing about the Lily Bulb permit that's scheduled for August, because there is a technical advisory group for that permit. And so I can flag for our staff to speak more specifically to that process and how it occurred for that permit. And then also the board, we are planning to bring to the board the first of the roads orders, that the investigative order for roads in the Wallala River watershed. We're planning to bring that to the board to consider adoption in December. And so we can make sure to thread that into that discussion, just to be speaking to specific projects. And then additionally, we'll look to provide you and the public some kind of broader information about the function of those groups across our permitting projects.
Are tag members, is it required? I don't think it is. Do they need to be public? I mean, for as much influence as they have over these processes, do the tag members, are they advertised or told to the public who's on these tag committees? I think they should be.
We are. That's an issue we're currently working through.
I think that might solve a lot of issues.
Yes. So we will certainly do some follow up on that.
Thank you.
By the December meeting, would you have a definition of roads?
Yes.
I would anticipate that that investigative order. I'm speaking slowly as Catherine comes to the microphone.
Hi, Catherine Carter, of your staff, supervisor of the Planning and Watershed Stewardship Division, in which the Wallala TMDL and the Wallala specific order and the region wide roads order is being developed. We just put out a frequently asked questions document, I think it was today, that does cover some specific questions about what is a road. I think it includes whether skid trails are on there or not, and I don't have it in front of me, so I won't speak to it, but we can share that with the board. And we can certainly update by December. I think the goal is people are speaking about something that we haven't begun to develop yet in any earnest way. And so what we're doing is receiving their questions of, be sure to define a road. That's how we're hearing it. And so at our earliest ability, we will certainly have that out. I think we should make it a priority to have something by December be able to share what we do have.
There's a road maintenance manual that was given to me in my early years on this board. Doesn't that define
what a probably road is? The Pacific Watershed Associates manual on road restoration work is my guess, and I would have to look at that to see what it said. And I hear Josh pulling the microphone towards himself. I'll let him.
Thank you. I wanted to just talk a little bit about the process so that people are clear. I think people got, because of the way the Wallala TMDL Action Plan got brought so close to us instigating the development of the assessment order in the Wallala and then the region-wide order, there's some confusion. And so when people say there's no definition of roads, we just had a meeting with some timber folks and they brought up some things to us about, well, what about this type of road that's been put to bed and no one's used it and no one's ever going to use it again? That's the process that we're currently engaged in, to learn that stuff so we can then develop, oh, okay, we don't want to include that. That's not a problem. Let's keep that out of the permit. Or this road that's going to be opened up again, maybe that one is included. And so we're actively having those discussions so that we can build the assessment order and the region-wide roads order in a way that makes sense and isn't absurd, and really tackles the problems of water quality and doesn't become something that's like too hard to implement. There's all sorts of pieces in that. That's where we are in this process. So we're learning that so we can put those into place. Everyone, I think, is focused on the TMDL action plan because it said we were going to address roads. Well, now we're going through the process of figuring out what that means. The public's highly engaged. Catherine's staff have probably done more outreach in the Wallala than I've ever seen any, certainly my time, seen anyone do in any watershed where we're doing work. And so I think people are just thinking we're further ahead in this process than we are. We are actively engaging with people now to make those decisions, to bring them to you so that you can make a decision on whether that's an appropriate action or not. Hopefully that helped. But
thank you.
One last follow-up question. Is the Wallala Roads, is this kind of the first domino or whatever analogy you want to use? First time you're really addressing the roads. I know there's the region-wide order, which is going to be things that aren't captured in these other permits. Is that a correct kind of summarization of it?
Yeah, either of us can. But yeah, I would say so. So the region-wide order is going to address roads that are significant sources of sediment that aren't already being addressed by other permitting actions.
Whether it's a TMDL or some other sort of thing.
Doesn't matter. Just like our vineyard order doesn't matter whether it's in a TMDL watershed or not. It's a vineyard order to protect water quality region-wide. That's what the roads order will be.
And if I could add to that, we hear these questions from you all today and from the public, and we are in the process of developing something that's going to very clearly lay out what was the role of the Wallala TMDL Action Plan? What is the role of the Wallala Specific Order? And what is the idea and what will the upcoming work on a region-wide order be to help answer some of these questions? The Wallala Specific Order is going to be requiring inventory assessment and prioritization of roads, but no actual implementation work. That is going to wait until the region-wide order. And that's part of, I think, what will be shared with people, is we want to make sure we take the time to be really thoughtful, get people's feedback, and go through the full public process on both of those orders, which we're just beginning now for the Wallala, and we're in the planning stages of for the region-wide. So people have come out early in a way, as Josh highlighted, because the TMDL has been out in the public forum, thinking we're further down the road potentially than we are. And what we're now implementing and embarking on is making sure that we get out, and we're going to be putting out some public draft of the Wallala sometime this summer. And that's when we're going to really be engaging and getting feedback from people. So there will be more definitive details and a public process that we heavily engage in.
And I'd like to recommend, sorry, go ahead. To interject. I'd like to recommend that we conclude discussion of this because it's not on the agenda. And I know there are a lot of members of the public that if the board is going to be discussing this, they'd like to have seen that on the agenda so they had the opportunity to listen in. So I'm going to recommend that we wrap this up and definitely note the questions and interest and continue it in the future when we can have it on a board agenda.
I was just going to say, great, thank you for that explanation. That was perfect. And my only thing would be, don't be afraid to really make sure you're putting the news to the entire region, not just the Wallala. So, entire thing. Okay, great.
Message received.
Great. With that, our next meeting is going Oops.
We got another item. Closed session.
Oh, gosh, sorry.
We often skip over that giant block of text, but sorry. Not today. So I'm recommending that the board meet in closed session to discuss item 7D, Roman numeral 7, that's under D.
Great. Moving to closed session. Okay. Are we going to the back?
Yep.
Okay, great.
Closed session to discuss item 7D7, and there is no action to report from that closed session.
Great. Thank you, Valerie. Our next meeting will be Thursday, May 7th at 9 a.m. in Eureka City Hall, City Council Chambers, 531 K Street, room 208, Eureka, California, at May 7th and 8th. With that, this meeting's adjourned.